For my reading, I've selected a passage from one of our truly fine meditation writers, Victoria Safford. She's a minister in White Bear, Minnesota. In a cemetery once, an old one in New England, I found a strangely soothing epitaph. The name of the deceased and her dates had been scoured away by wind and rain, but there was a carving of a tree with roots and branches, a classic 19th century motif. And among them, the words, "She attended well and faithfully to a few worthy things." Now, at first, this seemed to be a little meager, a little stingy in the part of her survivors. But I wrote it down and have thought about it ever since, and now I can't imagine a more profound and satisfying legacy. She attended well and faithfully to a few worthy things. Every day, I stand in danger of being struck by lightning and having the obituary in the local newspaper say, "For all the world to see, she attended frantically and ineffectually to a great many unimportant, insignificant things." How do you want your obituary to read? "He got all the dishes washed and dried before playing with his children in the evening. She balanced her checkbook with meticulous precision, but missed a lot of sunsets, missed a lot of love. Missed a lot, but her money was in order. He answered all his calls, all his emails, his voicemails, but along the way he forgot to answer the call to service, to compassion, to forgiveness, starting with himself. She could not or would not hear the calling of her heart. So my friends, how will it read? How does it read? If you had to name a few worthy things to which you attend well and faithfully, what, I wonder, would they be?" It's always a joy to return to Fullerton. I hope to keep doing this until about every year or so, until I look in the mirror and I say, "You're done. You're complete. You don't need to go out on the road anymore." But until that time, I'm still in retirement and go out about once a month to different congregations in our district. And I want to especially thank the Reverend Jason Cook, whom I've got to know over the last couple years. Fine person, fine minister. You're blessed. It's a mutually satisfying match. You're growing, you're strengthening, you're deepening. I ran into Lawrence he was on the way out this morning. He was going to another gathering. But I wish you well, and my wife and I can't make the celebration in September. But we wish you to keep growing and deepening and thickening your ministry. It takes all of you to contribute to that. And Judy, first time we've met. And thank you. You're a splendid contributor. This is a good fit for you. Worship Association, good fit for you. And Dale, I mean, my goodness, Dale and I go back a couple centuries. I mean, I can say it out loud. I mean, there's nobody that's been more attentive to my arrival in a congregation from the outside than Dale and his team here. And I want to say that out loud. And Claire's back there. I mean, yeah, there you are. You're going to Fullerton at Cal State next year. I drove by it. And Eleanor, it's like I've been here a few years. It's like we've grown up together. But then you're going off back east, right?
Well, I'm still here.
Yeah, you're still here. I mean, it's a wonderful balance you have of all generations here. It's really special. I'm looking out and seeing Dick Cole. We go back to 1967. 50th year of my ministry this year. I'm proud of that. I mean, if I were to go now or to quit now, I've been lucky and blessed to have been a part of various congregations, and we were a neighborhood church together in Pasadena way back in the late 60s. And I was thinking Nadia Felix might be here. Nadia's not here, I see, but she was a part of our San Diego congregation. So I have a lot of ties here and a lot of strong feelings about this congregation, and I hope to keep coming back once a year or so. I've got some books afterwards on a table so I can go home lighter. And a couple of them are very pertinent to the theme I'm talking about today. In fact, most of what I share today is in that, or in a couple of the books there. I want to dedicate the sermon today to my cousin Mary Catherine Lind. Mary Catherine is a couple months older than I am. She turned 76 in May and learned last January that she had a brain tumor that was inoperable. And she's doing all the treatment procedures and is enduring, and they gave her about 8 months, but she seems like she may extend beyond that. But in any case, two things about her transition here that I want to share, maybe three. The first one is she was named after my mother. Her mother is my mom's sister. Mary Catherine is my mom's name. And I'm thinking of what Chris and Gary sang today, Let It Be, the Beatles song that Paul McCartney wrote when he was 16 years of age, launched his career, still in his, he's in his mid-70s, a little bit younger than I am. Still going strong. But McCartney dedicated that to his mother, Mary, who had died when he was about 16 years of age. And he said, may I, when I'm four times this, when he wrote the song, When I'm 64, you remember that one? When I'm 64, four times what I am now, may I have some of the size of my mother. So when you sing Let It Be or When I'm 64, think about Mother Mary. As I think about my own Mother Mary, and my wife's mother is named Mary as well. And I dedicate this to Mary Catherine, and my cousin, who did a beautiful thing. She wrote a card to all of her friends and her family, a picture of herself on the cover of this little card. Had her with a bouquet of flowers. And inside she said, it was a thank you note. She said, my life, my days are numbered now, but I want to thank you all for being a part of my life. Real simple, real clear. I've got it on my desk at home. Mother Mary, days numbered. Mary Catherine. And a beautiful thing happened, the last thing is before I move on. She and her husband had been separated for a dozen years. And not trying to fill a void, but trying to play a supportive role as a cousin, we would go out to lunch. She lives in northern San Diego, and we live in central San Diego. And we'd go out to lunch together at a favorite Mexican cafe. And lo and behold, she said, on my final lap, sir, I'm going to ask my husband. They had not got a divorce yet in 12 years. If he'll come back and take me on home. And he's there doing the best he can. She's doing the best she can. A lot of ways to complete our lives, right? But my motivation today for the sermon is manifold. First of all, I'm 75, I'll be 76 this year, like my cousin. And a couple of the others of you in the room too. On your home stretch. I'm not embarrassed to talk about it. This is not a depressing topic. This is an enlivening topic. And one we need to share more with our children and grandchildren and all kinds of venues with people to help us have better deaths than we have. You may have read the relatively recent piece by the American oncologist and bioethicist Ezekiel Emanuel. on why he hopes to die at 75, contending that living too long, and yeah, often, sometimes, proves to be an immeasurable loss. That's an issue in our society. And he makes a provocative, edgy case, but on the whole, I don't agree with him saying everybody should close out at 75. And it's not only because that's where I am. It's not only because I'm staying consciously and positively and strategically and intentionally awake as long as I can. The second reason for today's theme, I owe God a death. My two best male friends, alongside my brother. My brother's 79, and he's my closest male friend. You know, we did something very precious. He's up in Oakland area, still doing psychotherapy, works with clients all over the country, a lot of works with rock entertainers and so forth. He's a therapist and psychology coach. I said, Phil, there's only you and me, and you've known me longer than anybody else who's still alive, and I want you to come down from San Francisco. We'll meet in the Burbank Airport. I'll come up from San Diego, and we're going to drive around for a couple days and all of the haunts and Pasadena, where we grew up. And we're going to eat dinner at the Colonial Kitchen, where Mom and Dad used to take us. And I want you to sing some songs to me tonight when we sleep in the beds next to one another. We slept usually in one bed for a long time. But I want you to sing some of the songs you've written, Phil. And we did. And we talked about when it comes, if he closes out first and completes his life, what he might want me to share. And I told him what I might want him to share if I go first. And you know, you don't go simultaneously, so you got to swap notes. And I said, I'm sort of the initiator. I'm the sentimentalist, although we're very close. He's very dear. And I said, we're doing this as long once or twice a year. We're doing this as long as we can. But my two best male friends, Paul and Nathan, died. And Nathan died eagerly, wanting to close out a pain-saturated existence. He did not want to go on any longer. In fact, when I would see Nathan, I would have to go to a nursing home after that to sing to people to lift my spirits. And I don't go down easily. But it was so depressing for me to see my brother not have any spark. There was no juice. There was no energy there. And so he needed to go. He wanted to go. He got to go. I miss him still. And then Paul died of a premature illness. It was undiagnosed until a couple months before, and he died of cancer quickly. And both of these guys had lined up to speak at my memorial. And I got to speak at theirs. And so my own mortality, again, please, this is not depressing. This is enlivening. What's depressing is that we don't deal with it. In fact, our own movement. When I was on the Commission on Appraisal, we were revising our purposes and principles. And we got a lot of returns from people that said, where's beauty? Beauty ain't in the list. And are you immortal? I mean, shouldn't death be mentioned? William W.H. Auden, the poet, said, until you consent to die, you can't really live. Where's death? It ain't in there. And then where's forgiveness, the ultimate form of love? Didn't make it. But we got returns from people all over the country, and due to procedural problems, we weren't able to modify it, and I'll be underground. But someday, I think we're going to deepen and thicken our purposes and principles. We need to. We need to, and death needs to be in there. I'm reminded of Thornton Wilder's poignant line, there's a land of the living and a land of the dead. The bridge is love. The only truth the only survival. Only love conquers death. These brothers and my dear cousin won't return in person. Only in love do I hold them still. And one more reason, my first book, Generation to Generation, interesting, it's 31 years ago, with the support of my father-in-law, the blessing, the energy, the support, he said, you can do it. Generation to generation, passing along the good life to your children. It's based on the Jewish ethical will concept. Because as you're completing your life, you pass on life lessons to your offspring. And if it isn't your offspring, it's kids down the block. You will confine youngers who need your wisdom as the olders need the wisdom of the youngers. And here I am in my final book, Growing All the Way to the Grave, Poems on Conscious Aging and Mindful Dying. But anyway, my sermon title comes from a quote from the essayist Wallace Stegner, one of our best naturalists. Wallace Stegner. Revisit him. He said, I've been lucky. I came from nowhere and had no reason to expect as much from this one life as I've got. I owe God a death and the earth a pound or so of chemicals. Now let's see if I can remember that when my time comes. Yes, we owe God, we owe the universe, we owe ourselves, we all owe all whom we love and meet along the path. One death, you don't need to go overboard. One death, especially if you've been blessed like I have with a full, generous existence. And it's got to be paid when it comes your time to enter the ground. Picture two children talking to one another around a tree, and the younger one says, it's a beautiful tree, isn't it? Yeah, it is, says the older child. But it's a shame that we won't be around to see it when it's fully grown. And the younger one moans, but why? Where are we going? You see, young children don't really envision death or a finish line, certainly not their own. They understand sleep and separation, but not death, not the cessation of physical life. And when the moment is right, when the time is there, we've got to help them and companion them so they know that gone is gone. Not just pass away. Death is death. To be sure, we adults have our own problems with it, don't we? What a death-defying culture we are. Note the recent AARP magazine. Good magazine. I read it all the time. Lead article, front page, 20 ways to live longer. How about three ways to live stronger? It's not about length. It's not about duration. It's about thickness, power, meaning. Will we face death in 10 weeks or 10 years or several decades? And what exactly will be the form of the greeting? And which particular indignities, you don't usually avoid all of them, which particular indignities might be in store for you or me? Well, whether death comes as a sooner or later, as a relief or as an outrage, we need to be prepared. That means making sufficient peace with its inevitability. Remember Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and Raymond Moody, great scientists and medical personnel, blending philosophy and science, and they did some very substantial interviews of people who were clinically dead and then came back. And the good news is that all of them, from their reports, said, you know, it was peaceful and calm and serene. No sweat, no worry. That's good news. But none of these components and none of these reports provide conclusive evidence of an afterlife. personally, I've come to sort of benevolent agnosticism about life after death or life after life. I don't anticipate one, and I don't hunger for one. But there might just be one. As a universalist, that's the door I came in. Unitarian freedom, reason, and tolerance. Good instrumental values. Universalism, hope, courage, and love. Oh, terminal values. That's the door I came in. I'm a universalist at heart. I believe in everlasting love. I harbor no worries. Because whatever happens when I die, love will be the container. That's where my mother and I grew to agree. She from the perspective of her Christianity, and I from the perspective of my universalism. And whether or not there is life after death, there is love after death. For as long as we need. There is a love holding me. There is a love holding you. There is a love holding all. And we rest in that love. But whether death is final or not, it remains real. As the World Health Organization reports, the world death rate is holding steady at 100%. There's a corollary. The spiritual danger of focusing upon life after death is the temptation to treat this existence as merely a warm-up, as unimportant compared to the goodies you're going to get in the great beyond. Well, when you get to be my age, too many of my sisters and brothers are coasting on home. The little ones need us. The people on the edges need us. To bring the wisdom and the savvy and the flaws and the foibles that you and I in our 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s have mustered. We need to deliver them. And not just within our own family network. As we say in our Unitarian Universalist Memorial Celebrations, right at the outset, Joseph Doakes has died and you and I are alive. So you know who's dead in the room and who's alive still. It's a reality. The spirit may live on, consciousness may live on, but the body of the dead person has irretrievably expired, and that difference must be saluted rather than camouflaged and euphemisms like he's gone away, or she's passed on or transitioned. Being dead is dead. In the Jewish burial ceremony, the family's urged to shovel dirt on the coffin of the deceased. And the thud of the dirt on the coffin is blunt. It can jolt the heart. But hearing that thud impresses upon those surviving that this passage of death is utterly real. A fellow human being has been placed into the ground and will never return to touch and be touched by us physically. Death's not only inevitable, it's also natural in the overall sweep of things. About 5 million years ago, something happened on this earth that both dwarfed and made possible every succeeding event. Up to that time, death, as we understand it, didn't exist. But neither did life. All the living that was done was a kind of organic slime made up of algae and amoebas, whose life was one of continuous existence, growing at one end and sloughing off at the other. And then, into that drowsy world of immortal slime, came a transfiguring event, and life as we understand it began, the truly individual form of life, and crabs and sponges and trilobites, and yeah, you and I, whole worlds were on its way. So if we conceive of life as a gift, as a good, that we must conceive of death as a gift and as a good. If there exists any part of creation, any person that we love, we must say this is possible because of death. Without death, there would be neither that which we love nor the ability to love at all. That's how much we owe death. I'll go further. Death is desirable as well as inevitable and natural. Now, as a minister of 50 years, I've buried too many kids. On our memorial wall at First Church in San Diego are the names of all the people who chose to be have their names on that wall. Birth year and death year, that's all you get. An equalizer, huh? So when Tommy Gallagher on his bicycle was hit by a car and killed at 8 years of age, Tommy Gallagher got 8 years on there. And he's up there. And I'd often, and Carolyn as well, go and spend time in front of the memorial while remembering sisters and brothers who had died during our 24 years there. The young death, I'm not a friend of that. Premature death, I'm not a friend of that. But on the whole, when it comes to a completion, there's a desirability. I was on a TV show a while back, and I was just having a dialogue on with a gentleman on immortalism, the philosophy that we can and should live forever. And the spokesperson of the approach of cryogenics seemed relatively unfazed by my remarks until I told him unabashedly that if I could live forever in my current condition, I'd turn down the offer. I didn't want to live forever. Everlastingness held no appeal to me. Oh, it'd be nice to be in touch with a few folks, maybe, if that's the way it goes, but let's be honest. You don't want that eternal, boring, everlastingness of the bonds without justice and struggle and strife and difficulty and tragedy and the marriage of joy and sorrow. What kind of life is that? What kind of extension is that, really? I don't want it. And I told him, and he said, well, anybody that was anybody, especially you, Reverend, he said, anybody that's anybody wants to live forever. I said, I'm sorry, I don't. And I left the room. Did you ever hear an evangelist describe heaven in terms of the challenges waiting to be faced, or in terms of passion or toil or mercy or justice? No, it's always in Elysian fields, sort of Palm Springs on a year-round irrigation. Heaven is characterized by terrible constancy, no further growth or change or struggle taking place, destitute of variation, destitute of wrestling. How boring. How eternally boring. But to put it positively, death's presence intensifies my capacity and my drive to love and create meaning this afternoon. Every moment with which I'm blessed grows precious. My life possesses daily urgency and challenge because I won't always be around. My dad died at 81 and a half. So did my father-in-law. That's the average length for a man. I got about 5 more years. Who says I'm going to get more? I may not. It doesn't matter, does it? Because it's what matters truly to me is being fully present and accounted for this afternoon and on into the evening when we're hosting a party at our house. And then tomorrow when I meet with a guy at the church to swap songs that we're going to bring into a nursing home, and he's bringing me a Merle Haggard song when Merle was in prison in his 20s. And he was planning with Rabbit, one of the inmates, to escape. And Rabbit said, no, Merle, look, stay where you are. You play a pretty good guitar in your 20s here. You're doing okay. You sing. Let me go. He escaped. Rabbit escaped. Killed somebody. Returned to prison. And the song is, sing my way back home. Because he wanted Merle, Rabbit, as he was going to his execution, to sing him a song That his mother sang to him when he was growing up, there's good in everyone's life, there's beauty in everyone's life. And this was a gospel song that rabbits' mothers would sing that brought him joy and memory. And he wanted that memory, and he wanted Merle to sing me back home with that gospel song. You know, if we don't have an eternity with one another, then we've got to seize the time for one another, to treasure each singular season, because we might just not experience another one. How many of us would clean up the environment? How many of us would grow a beloved community? How many of us would raise healthy children, either our own or somebody else's? How many of us would volunteer at the homeless center or do anything of much importance if we believed we had an eternity in which to do it? Yeah, I owe God a death. And a death that resembles the way in which I tried to live. A death that doesn't contradict the conduct of my vocation, my partnership, my family, my way of life. You only get one death. So live it as lovingly and as boldly and as fruitfully as possible. A good death permits us to be pretty much the same person dying as we were when we're alive. We're not going to all get that. Nathan struggled for 3 years in his nursing home, not wanting to live. His wife would visit and with the dirty clothes, pick up the dirty clothes and clean them and bring them back. And it was an intolerable situation for her. He didn't want her there. She didn't want to be there. He didn't want to be alive. That happens sometimes. And a good death doesn't mean I'll die peacefully, although I'd like that. I don't want to live via prolonged misery. A good death is more than going to sleep one night and not waking up, although I'll take that too. A good death is when I go back into the ground essentially clean of regrets and resentments. And so do you or I have something to we want to say or be or do before we die? If so, don't dawdle. Don't dawdle. Now, I recognize that my name won't last forever, maybe sooner be forgotten than I desire imagine, and my labors and visions will be lost in the shuffle. And for sure, all my sermons and books will be taken to the dump. If not by my children or grandchildren, by somebody sometime along the line. But I do hope, maybe you can identify with this too. Can we hope that our peculiar struggles and our curious gifts will influence a slew of people in some small way for some length of time? I want to end with some comforting news. Because remember that love I talked about? At least for universalists. I don't know. I can't speak for people from other religious traditions. The universalists that we claim to be and the shoulders upon which we sit, we were graciously ushered into being as a gift beyond our earning. We're statistical miracles. I didn't deserve to be here. You didn't deserve to be here. We're absolutely statistical miracles. Totally lucky. There's no need to discuss or debate the particular form such love might take when we die. No one knows. I'm not interested in discussions. I'm interested in an affirmation, a trust, a claim that I will be held by the same love that drives me to love right now. That's all I need in my better moments, higher moments. So with quivering gratitude, I second the sentiment of the Song of Solomon in the Hebrew Scriptures that love is stronger than death. Love outlasts death, at least for a while, and that's enough. So, my dear mortals, in the end, death's justice comes to everyone. In order to make room for other creatures to birth on the scene, I personally resonate with the way that Stegner put it. I've been lucky. I came from nowhere and had no reason to expect so much from this one life as I got. I owe God a death and the earth a pound or so of chemicals. Now let's see if I can remember that when my time comes. I can picture myself now, as I told you, in San Diego, we have a memorial garden, and it's actually being expanded right now. We've got some gifts to expand it so we can have more names on the wall. And we would often, Carolyn and I, when we'd meet new prospective members, we'd say, what are you looking for in this congregation? What are you looking for? What do you need in your life right now? And then, what can you bring us? This is a covenant. This is like a marriage. This is like a partnership. What can we bring one another during your stay here as a newly consecrated member of our congregation? And then we'd take a stroll. We'd talk as long as we needed to talk. And then we'd take a stroll out on our property, and we'd look down in the canyon behind. I don't know if any of you have been to San Diego. We have a canyon behind our sanctuary where we would scatter cremains. Oh, the moments there. Oh, the moments of scattering cremains when the whole family's there. I'll never forget our grandson who helped us with one memorial, and he was 4 years of age, and he was carrying the cremains, the container, the sacred container we had of the cremains, but he was with us. And so we could talk about cremains. And, you know, much as people our age could talk with a 4-year-old about cremains, but we did it. But anyway, prospective members, we would show them where we scattered cremains. We would show them the memorial wall. And then we would talk about Tommy Gallagher, the 8-year Swanson who died at 100 years of age, whoever was on the wall. And on that wall, there's a passage, and I'll close with this. For you shall go out in joy and be led forth in peace, and the mountains and the hills before you shall break forth into singing, and all the trees of the field shall clap their hands.